This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
From the streets of Hamburg, Germany, welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. As always, I'm your host, Shane Told, as I bring you conversations with me and other lead singers. And yes, I am right now standing on the streets in Germany. I am on tour here with my band Silverstein. We're doing a 14-date German tour, which is a lot of shows to do in a country the size of Germany. But, you know, usually we do something like 4 to 7, but this time we decided to do a whole bunch. It is going super well so far, all sold out. And a big shout out to all the sinners, all the German sinners that have come and said hi. Always love it when people come up to me and tell me they love the show, especially all over the world. It's just so cool that, you know, people in Germany are listening to the show week after week. Anyways, thanks for tuning in. Again, we have a great episode. I speak to Sebastian Granger of Death From Above, formerly Death From Above 1979. One of the coolest bands from Toronto, a two-piece band, a band that's done a lot of really cool and special things, and a band that is in a lot of genres, but at the same time, not really in any genres. Very hard to categorize, very hard to pigeonhole them in any type of way, and I love that. And thanks again to Sebastian for jumping on and doing the show this week. Before we get into that, as always, if you want to get in touch, it's super easy. Email leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. We're on all the social media stuff. And if you're not so happy, we do have the hate line. Feel free to give me a call, leave me a message, and give me some hate. The phone number is 657-666-HATE. I also want to remind you guys to make sure you're subscribed to the podcast. We have episode 100 coming up, and leading up to episode 100, we have some of the best episodes we've done of this show, and I want to make sure that you guys aren't going to miss anything, so make sure you hit the subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on, so it can come right to your device every week, and you don't miss a thing. And of course, if you like the show, feel free to write a review on iTunes. That all does really go a long way in helping this thing grow. And of course, word of mouth too. You know, tell a friend, tell a loved one, tell a brother, tell a sister. And together we can put this thing into the podcast stratosphere. Anyways, let's keep the intro short this week and let's jump in with Sebastian Granger of Death From Above.
Hello.
Hey, man. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Fantastic.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah. I'm here. I'm here with Mississauga's finest, Mr. Sebastian Granger.
I still get the Mississauga trophy. That's great.
Come on. Well, I'm from Oakville, so
hell yeah.
So
yeah.
We gotta start from the beginning, the origin. Sometimes.
You ever take the 26A or B bus in Mississauga?
No, I'm from Oakville, so I've got that rich kid money. So I always had a car. You know.
You got a good postal code.
I have an L6H postal code. Yes, I do.
I didn't drive until I was 31. So
really,
yeah.
Well, some people are late bloomers, and that's okay.
I'm definitely one of those.
Well, sort of. I mean, we could talk about the old days. We could talk about. There's so much to talk about. It's great to have you on the show, but I do want to talk about Death From Above being back. New record. Outrage is out now.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, man. How are things?
I'm going to say hell yeah a bit too much on this podcast.
I like the positivity.
I'm going to try to not say, you know, because apparently that's just this like trope in Jesse and I's interview vernacular. And I did a podcast recently and someone counted that I said it. I think it was 88 times in 30 minutes.
Yeah, but these motherfuckers have too much time on their hands. They're actually listening, not even listening to you saying you know.
Well, I asked him to go back. I asked him to forensically go back and count because I started noticing it. And, I sent up a free record. So it was, oh, did I do it?
You did one. Yep.
Ding, 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 ding. All right. Ring the bell.
Well, you know what I always say? People call me out on these podcasts. I always say that's interesting. I always say that word for some reason.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you're going to hear me say that a couple of times as well. But, you know, I did it. I did a you know. Oh, yeah. No, and the other one, too, that people that tend to be our age, and 1979 really gives away your birthday, by the way. I don't know.
I know. Yeah. It's.
Yeah, you're like, fuck, really? Now that we're old guys. When you were young and cool, it was fine.
I had a flight attendant come up to me recently, and she saw my arm, and I've got a tattoo of it on my arm, and she asked me what the numbers were, and I said, it's my birth year, and she went, oh, okay, yeah, well, my daughter's starting to get tattoos, and I don't know how I feel about it. I was like, well, tell her to not get her birth year tattooed on her, because it's cute when you're 22. It's not as cute when you're 38.
Yeah, and when you're like 51, it's going to be a little bit even worse, I think.
It's going to be better.
Maybe it will be better.
Cycles. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I forget where I was with all this, but new record, dude. So are you excited? What's going on? I feel like your band has had a lot of sort of ups and downs, starting strong, going away for a while, coming back, and now a new record. Is it a hell yeah kind of situation right now? Is that why you're going to say hell yeah so much? Are you just really stoked on things?
Yeah, I'm very stoked. I feel great about our record. I had a blast making it, and it's kind of the accumulation of all of the things that I'd like to do with recording.
Cool.
So it's, I didn't hold back as much as I had on, I think that earlier I was, everything was so new. And I was kind of trying on different personalities in a way. And then going out and having, you know, kind of mid-level flight solo jaunt, I was able to explore a lot more of my own, like, specific interests. And then when we came back and did the second record, Physical World, I was unsure how much of myself I should expose in the whole thing. It sounds weird to say. But,
no, it doesn't. No, I can understand that, sure.
Yeah, and then this time around, it was like, that wasn't even a thought. It was just, let's just make something that we both really like, you know?
No, totally. Well, the one thing that struck me is I know you worked with Eric Valentine, and he's a guy a little outside your world. You know what I mean? He does a lot of mainstream kind of stuff and, like,
yeah,
pop
definitely.
Punk and you know, kind of big rock records in a way.
Yeah.
Was it going, I don't know if you knew him or you worked with him before on anything or whatever, but, like, having a producer like that, I feel, could be a little bit scary in, like, pushing a record in a direction you might not be comfortable with.
It's funny. My initial instincts when we were, like, kind of on a search for producers and his name came up, and I didn't know who he was until I looked at his, his credentials. And I was really intimidated by the sort of the spectrum of things he'd worked on, because I couldn't see us in that, you know, sure, there's some dwarves and there's some heavier stuff on there. And like, you know, we were just full on trying to rip off the sound, the drum sound on Songs for the Deaf when we were trying to self-produce our last record. So there's definitely things in his wheelhouse that resonate with us, but the breadth of his career was intimidating. And it was Jesse that mentioned, he's like, listen, dude, look at all of the different things he's done, and do any of those bands sound alike, you know? And it's like, not really. And he noted that, you know, that's probably because the guy just makes everything sound like itself, you know?
Right.
And when we met him, we went on kind of a blind date, at his studio, and that was exactly, like, there was no, pretense or facade. It was just pure, like, he talked about our demos, talked about the songs, talked about the technical stuff he would do. He builds his own gear. He's like, his father was a rocket scientist.
Oh, he's super,
he's
nerd,
like a super nerd, smart, you know, super kind. You know, his studio is called Barefoot, and he doesn't wear shoes. You know, like, he's totally just like salt of the earth kind of guy. Nice. Really into space, telescopes, and rock and roll. So it was it was great. And you know, I mean, I spent every hour that this record was in production. I was there. You know, I was in the studio for every minute of it. So to have a guy like him to, you know, in that sense, to really collaborate with. And not get sick of, like, we still are fond of one another and text each other and, you know, and see each other and do things. So it was, you know, it feels like it was the beginning of a long relationship, which
that's
is nice.
Cool. That's really cool. Yeah. I had a podcast I did I do like these bonus episodes, and I talked to a producer we'd worked with, and it's funny cause you spend so much time with a producer on a record. Right. And then a lot of times it's like done. And it's like, okay, we're done tracking. Well, thanks, see ya. And then, like, you don't even talk to them. Yeah. And it's such a weird thing to have somebody so close in your life, and then all of a sudden you're just like, yeah, I don't know, I guess we're, like, cool, but it's just, you know, that's such a funny dynamic, too, that happens sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, also with your band being the two of you guys, you'd think there'd be even more importance on a producer of having that third man, because, like, I worked on some solo stuff myself, and it was just me and the engineer producer. And there's always that time when you're like, well, I don't know. What do you think? And you're like, well, I don't know. And you like look for that third person. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the tiebreaker person, the you know what I mean? You need to have that kind of mediator, I'm sure, between you and Jesse. So was he that guy? And did his personality really work for that?
Definitely. I mean, we're at a point where we just really... we really know each other, you know, like Jesse and I really, you know, we're like brothers in a sense. And I understand the way he wants to approach recording, and it's the same as it's been for him, you know, since he was probably 15 years old. He just wants to go in. He's like Frank Sinatra, wants to go in, do it and get out, you know? And I'm the kind of guy that just wants to, you know, sit and really work on something, like keep going until, you know, I'll go all night. And so, because we've accepted sort of those roles in one another, you know, I needed someone to, you know, spend a lot of time with, you know, Jesse, he's able to come in and like do his thing. And he, you know, he's the kind of guy that generally doesn't get better with takes, you know, he does the thing that he does, and then you know, it kind of starts to go downhill maybe a little bit, so
right.
But that's something he's self-aware of, and so we try to, you know, structure it in a way that so we can capture him at his best all the time, and then all of the sort of the grunt work of, you know, as a lyricist and writing melodies, the grunt work of figuring out exactly how I want to reduce an idea down to a rock and roll lyric, you know, like that. Sometimes that happens very quickly, and other times that happens over the course of weeks, you know, so, and that's not necessarily something that he needs to be present for all the time.
Right.
So it really works out. And when we were trying to self-produce this record, again, we keep making that mistake of thinking we can make it on our own. You know, we kind of, because we're our default position is to be kind to one another. We don't like to over criticize each other. So, it gets challenging to push the music forward in a way that we want to push it. We need that third person to make sure that we're at our best all the time, you know?
Right. No, it's just that dynamic of two people. And mm-hmm. also just the understanding. It's really funny because when you were in the middle of your explanation, before you kind of got to the meat of it, I was like, well, that's a singer thing. You know, mm-hmm. like it's a singer thing to be like, well, I have these lyrics and I have these melodies and like I want everything to be perfect. And a lot of it stems from a place of being that kid from Mississauga, from Oakville, that's like, well, I'm a little self-conscious about my voice. I don't know if I'm the best singer. You know what I mean? Yeah. And like, as you get older, yes, you get better. But a lot of times the way you've always done things, the way Jesse's done records since he was 15, you're the same way. You're set in your ways a little bit too.
Yeah.
So I think that's very interesting.
Yeah, I'm still the guy that wants to stay up all night recording my voice into a 4-track and listening back to it and going, oh, aren't I so clever, you know?
That's very funny. So you're in Los Angeles right now. What are you doing out there at the moment?
I live here with my wife.
Oh, she's live here there. Oh, I didn't know you live there now.
Yeah, she's a filmmaker. So this is kind of the spot to be in. Yeah, we got a dog and a view. And it's funny. She's... I flew in yesterday. We were in Europe for promo, and I landed at 9 p.m. and she took off at like 6 p.m. to go to Europe for film related things. So we just missed each other.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah. But that's the life.
That's the reality. Yeah. So how long have you been in L.A.? Do you miss Toronto?
Not particularly. We've been here for about 5 years now. We went back when Jesse and I were starting to work on this last batch of songs, and also for visa related boring bureaucratic issues.
Sure.
But I've always kind of reveled in the idea of like starting anew, you know, and I don't know what it was earlier in my life, but definitely like in high school, I went to a French, all French high school. I went to Saint Famille with all the kids I basically like went to kindergarten with, you know, all the way up to grade 11. And for 12 and 13, I went to a different high school, and that for me was really an awakening, you know, like a renaissance in a sense. For me, like I'd never been to public school, and I'd never been exposed to, you know, all the stuff that basically laid the foundation for what I do now, which is, dare I say, punk rock, but the sort of art side of music,
right,
and you know, DIY-ness of it, and that was something I wasn't exposed to. I mean, at least ideologically, I was, you know, I was definitely doing things on my own, but it wasn't part of a scene in any way.
Yeah, well, totally. I mean, Mississauga too was like very disconnected, I found. Like, if you want to talk about when we were kids, you know, Mississauga kind of had like, it was just like this black hole between like where there was kind of cool shit going on in Toronto and where there was cool shit going on like in Hamilton, Burlington, Oakville area. And Mississauga didn't have as much going on. While we're on the subject though, let's talk about the early days. Saint Famille, what about your old bands like Fourth Day Sun?
I've mentioned this a couple of times before, but we never officially broke up. So I still,
still on the table.
Still going strong. Yeah, that was just, you know, it was my high school band. It was basically the band that started with me and a guitar player. I was playing drums and, you know, we started in whatever grade 7 or so. And then, the people that, you know, the guy that was the quote unquote roadie who helped us, you know, load our amps onto stage at the Mississauga Public Library later became our singer. You know, it's that kind of just like kid stuff.
yeah.
And then
later there was Remedy, right?
No, they were all the same band.
Same band.
We just kept having name changes.
That's
also in my DNA.
No, well,
changing the name all the time.
No, it's funny. I just like to bring up these things I know that no one else knows. And literally, if someone tries to Google Fourth Day Sun, nothing will come up. There's nothing out there.
No, we changed our name to Fourth Day Sun after I went to summer camp and discovered Sunny Day Real Estate. And I thought we needed a cooler name. We needed a cooler name than Remedy with, you know, whatever. It's fun.
Yeah, it is. It is fun, and I like reminiscing. But yeah, no, I mean the old days, like Mississauga. I do kind of like, I was saying Mississauga was this black hole with nothing. But now I'm remembering like there were shows at like the Aaron Mills Church and the Masonic Lodge.
Yeah, Kinsman Hall and
Kinsman Hall
stuff in Meadowvale. There was like there was this big annual rock Jingle Bell Rock thing and sort of the Meadowvale Streetsville scene. There was like a lot of stuff going on and. I was partially exposed to it through my older brother, just because he had friends in Meadowvale and Streetsville, And, but I didn't really get too involved in like the quote unquote scene ever really, you know, right. It was just, I would go to shows and I'd see like, I'd be fascinated with how it worked. Like, how are all these people here and what brought them here? And then discovering that it was just like, oh, that guy in that band put this show on. And I was like, well, I have a band, I can do that too. And, you know, discovering that, you know, you just, all you need is a couple hundred bucks to rent the place out or whatever it was. So it was less affiliated with like a scene or, you know, anything specific. It was just the idea that you can put on a show. And when I put on shows, there would be like, you know, totally incongruous acts. Like it would be like, you know, my band, which was like, you know, totally in the, would be considered in the alt rock world with like yes. a little bit of the Sunny Day Real Estate influence. And then there'd be like another, like, you know, sort of like minded band, a hardcore band, an acoustic performer, like a guy with a 303, you know, there's all yeah. kinds of weird shit. So, it was really more about the idea that you can just like, you can just do the thing, you know, not so much, the style or the genre of music or whatever.
No, totally. But that was, there was a kind of a beauty to that too, though, you know, that kids could come out and see all these different bands. And I loved how some of the trends would come and go. Like there was an era where like pretty much every band just sounded like Korn. You know, you remember that?
Remember that one.
You don't remember that?
I don't remember that.
Oh yeah. It was like totally a thing. And then like a little later, every band just wanted to sound like Hatebreed. There were all these like little like pockets of time. But I mean, there was like Black Cat Number 13. Wasn't Jesse in that band?
Yeah, he was the drummer.
That was a great band. That was a great band.
Yeah, they were great. I mean, the first time I played with them, I was just so floored by him specifically. Like I'd known Mark McLean, who played bass, just through people I went to high school with. And but seeing Jesse play was like a revelation. This guy was, he looked like an insane person. He had a weird haircut. He dressed weird. And when he played, he looked like a skin colored blur, you know, and he played a double kick pedal, and it's just totally, completely, you know, perpendicular to anything else that I'd seen before. And so I don't remember if that was the first time I'd actually seen him or met him, or if it was, you know, it's there's some mishmash of the timeline right. there, but definitely, it sounds hokey to say now, but, and it, you know, it definitely is hindsight and all those things, but somehow magically, like I saw a future in that guy. It's really bizarre. But even back then,
no, it's not bizarre, because there's people, and you can notice it, you know, people very young. It's like some people just have this sort of, you just know they're going to be successful, or you know that they get it. And it isn't always something so quantitative. You know what I mean? It can just be this just glimmer in their eye when you're like, ah, that guy's just got it. Like that guy's a star, which is sort of a lame thing to say, but it really is true.
No, but it's also the, because that is definitely true. When I first saw Jesse on the street, he looked like, he was like wearing a leather jacket and, you know, he looked fucking cool. And, but there was also, because I liked, you know, I was a bit of a weirdo growing up, and in a sense felt a little bit other always. When I saw him and seeing him when I was, you know, 20 or so, and seeing a guy that was a couple of years older and was just as serious about music as I was, and at a time when I felt like I was taking a chance with being that serious about it while my friends were going away to university and, you know, becoming something. And I was just like, well, I still want to, you know, make rock music or right. whatever I wanted to make.
Yeah.
And he had that same mentality. Like he took it seriously. And so that was the thing that I saw. I was like, oh, there are other people that are still, you know, they don't even, it's not like I considered it a dream. It was just like, this was the path, you know? And he had that same path. Yeah.
Well, how come you ended up on drums and he didn't?
how come I ended up on drums? I think it was through, we played in the band Femme Fatale together, which was his solo project.
I forgot about that band. Yeah.
And I think Black Cat was, maybe he played drums in other bands, but Black Cat was like the band he played drums in, you know, he played guitar and synth and other things. And then in Femme Fatale, he was just the singer, although he wrote all the songs and the parts, and then we would learn them.
Yeah.
And so I got into the mode of like that kind of spazzy drumming, through that project. And then, when we made Death From Above, the idea was that we would write, these kind of basic bass and drum parts and then get two other people to play those parts. And we, Jesse and I would play lead guitar over the whole thing and kind of sing, I guess. Or we were going to get another singer. There was this guy that looked really great at this bar that we'd hang out at. And, he looked like Gary Newman. He was amazing. And we were like, we should start a band where, you know, we play guitar and this guy sings, 'cause he looks great. And that never panned out. We started writing the songs and then thought, you know, that's pretty much all you need. And we had a drummer for one rehearsal where I sang, where I was just the singer. And then the next day, you know, we just played together and just kept doing that. Very circumstantial.
There you go. Well, shout out to Gary Newman. Well, I mean, you guys just need to capitalize on that 21 Pilots money, right? That's what's going on.
Mm.
So how about those comparisons? Are you getting those comparisons yet?
I didn't realize what they were until I saw them on SNL. Like, we played a festival, like a radio fest thing with them. And they're playing the stage like next to us, I guess. And while I was setting up my drums, I could hear them playing. It sounded like a mixtape, you know, like it sounded like, oh, there's a little EDM, there's a little reggae, there's a little screaming, there's some punkness to it. I found it was like, so difficult to pin down. I was like, this is such a weird genre of music. And then when I looked over, the crowd was huge. Okay, well, they're doing something.
They figured something out, yep.
Yeah, it wasn't until I saw them on SNL that I saw that there was a guy playing bass and a guy playing drums.
That's funny. So is there like, when you guys are recording, and again, you've got two people, do you do all the drums? Does Jesse jump in? Does Jesse say, oh, play it like this? Is it like very collaborative like that, instrument to instrument? Or do you guys kind of have like, nope, this is sort of my department? Like, how does that work? I'm just interested in that.
Yeah, we're open to, we share, you know, ideas. So, because he comes from more of like a heavy kind of, you know, hardcore metal kind of background, spazzy weirdo background, he has like ideas about how, drums should sound. And sometimes he'll come up with a riff idea and I just have no idea what to do with it. And then in those cases, I'm just like, dude, just like demo the drums, show me what you think it should be. And then I'll try to kind of stay, you know, pretty close to that idea. And likewise with him, sometimes, you know, I'll just write riffs. But always when we're writing, like when I'm writing a bass part, I'm thinking about something he would enjoy to play, or thinking about, you know, a progression that would be kind of in his imagination already, you know? So we, in that sense, we write for each other. And, it's really who, you know, it's really about the ideas. If it's a good idea, then it flies. And if it's not a good idea, it ends up just kind of withering away.
You must have times when when you're so opposite though. Like when, do you ever watch the Metallica documentary, Some Kind of Monster?
Oh, I've watched it probably a dozen times. And
like, it's one of my favorite things ever. And and why I love it so much, there's two of my favorite parts in the movie. And what I love is that the biggest band in the world has the same problems that Fourth Day Son probably had, you know, when you guys were kids in Mississauga, Ontario, Canada.
Sure.
Literally, there's a part where Hetfield's like playing some riff, and Lars is playing along, and Hetfield goes, "Hey man, just play it regular." Yeah. And Lars is like, "What do you mean regular, man?" You know. And then there's another part where Hammett is like trying to get this chug part, like just this chug pattern, and he can't figure it out. And it's like, I'm just watching it, and I can figure it out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's like these little things that happen. And to relate that back to you guys, it's like, does that ever happen when you're like, you're just like, you hear something and you wrote this riff, or he wrote this riff and you're playing this drum part and he's like, "No man, just like play it regular." And you're like, I think it sounds fucking stock.
It's not that. I actually have a specific memory of my first band in my sitting in my friend's living room with the drum kit and a guitar and a piano, whatever else we were using. And my bud Dave, like, turning around saying, "Can you just hit the cymbal in the same spot every time, not in a different spot every time?" You know, like, for example, with a song on there's a song on our new record called Moonlight. And, when I heard the demo, to me, it sounded like just total metal. There's like a double kick pattern in it. And I play the double kick, but I play it in like a particular way. I play it kind of to do triplet things and kind of Bonamy style fills, but I don't play it like, you know, Mike Portnoy or whoever else.
Cannibal Corpse,
Or like a fucking drum magazine dude. So I was nervous about playing that part, and in the studio I flat out, you know, I told Jesse, I was like, "Dude, if I don't nail this like within like the hour, then you're up," you know.
Right.
But luckily I snuck in some rehearsal time over the holidays, so I was able to do it. But yeah, it's not, I think that's where the producer buffer comes in for us.
Exactly.
When we were working on the songs and kind of under the delusion that we were actually making a record about a year ago, there were definitely some frustrating times when, you know, especially, I don't know if you've ever sat behind the kit, but
I dabble.
Yeah, it's really difficult for me to. It's so all encompassing physically and mentally that there's not a lot of room for you know, criticism, or like I kind of get a little bit like flat creatively.
Right.
So that's why for me, like, I need to take like a songwriter dude, I have to take the songs out of that environment. Like, I can't sit behind the drums and write a song. Like, I just, it's just not in my skill set. So those two things, like the drummer and singer, definitely have different jobs and they work different hours.
Yeah, it's true. Well, yeah, I mean, that's obvious, like, elephant in the room is just drumming and singing at the same time. That's not that common. There's been guys that have done it, and some to great success. Phil Collins is one of only three guys that has sold 100 million records as a solo artist and with a band.
Yeah, well, band.
Can you name the other two?
What, as a singing drummer?
No. There's only three artists. A little trivia here. This will be fun. There's three artists that have sold 100 million records, both as a solo artist and with a band. Can you name them? Phil Collins is one. The other two are pretty easy.
Paul McCartney and Michael Jackson.
You got it. Nailed it.
Damn, that was easy.
Yeah, it was easy. But Phil Collins is the tricky one.
Yeah, he's tricky. He also, I mean, he gets the credit for being a singing drummer, but like those are two different terms. He's not like a singing drummer. Like he does it a little bit, but he when things get a little hairy on the kit, he pops off and some other bruiser takes over.
No. And here you are playing like sometimes technical double kick patterns while singing. And like, that must be tough for you. Like, let's say you make a record like you just did. The record just came out September 8th. And you're like, okay, now we got to go on tour. And I see you guys have a lot of tour dates coming up. I mean, do you have to figure out how to play these fucking songs? Because you haven't played them at the same time, I imagine. You've played the drums and then you've done the vocals in the booth.
Yeah,
you know, because 1 + 1 = 2 isn't that simple, right, with those two instruments.
No, First of all, the disclaimer is for any of your listeners, it's not something I recommend. I don't recommend anyone endeavor to do it. I get asked the question a lot by people who've, you know, seen me do it and ask, well, how do you, you know, how can I practice? It really is just practice, but like I usually tell them to not do it because it's, you know, it's hard. It's not recommended.
Right.
It does take quite a bit of rehearsal. Like we don't, Jesse and I don't live in the same city. So I have like, you know, I've got like a V drum kit in my garage. I go down there and play and sing along to get the parts right. And I, you know, slow it down and figure it out with the earlier material. I was writing in a way that was like more conducive to the task. And as I get older and stupider, I write more complicated melodies and parts and more ambitious vocal lines and things. So it gets more complicated. And honestly, I feel like I don't fully figure the song out until we've played it a bunch live, which is to the detriment of those early shows in a sense. And that's one of the not the detriment, cause it's still, you know, it's not like we're ripping anyone off, but it needs to be the song, the way it's performed live needs to be worked out in front of an audience in my mind, you know, just, I know. That's the way it's always been.
It's something people don't talk about. Like at one band rehearsal, somebody once said to me that one show is equal to 10 band rehearsals. And I'm like, that's probably pretty accurate.
Yeah,
you know, because
yeah.
It's not until you play in front of people that you understand. And sometimes my favorite is when you play a song in front of people and you're all of a sudden you're like, shit, man, this is like, this song isn't like, doesn't really rock. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like when you're it's the most self-conscious you ever are about the song when there's a crowd of people. When you're in your practice space, you're like, oh yeah, this is sick. So it is amazing how it changes.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard in this day and age, with, you know, all of the, everyone's kind of spying on you and filming your every move. It's hard to get away with those moments. We did a tour, right before we made our last record. We did a tour where we went out and played a bunch of small bars and clubs across Ontario and Eastern Canada and played new material. Some things didn't even have lyrics or melodies yet. And we had to go out and kind of work on the music and see what worked live. And without the kind of critical eye of the internet audience. And so we asked the fans to not record, and by and large, they were very respectful of it. There's no, I haven't tried to search for it, but doesn't appear to be any footage of it online anywhere, right. Which is cool. And
very cool.
That was really, really helpful to that record.
No, that's, I think that's awesome, man. No, I was going to ask you, like, what happens if you drop a stick? Like that must be really challenging. Like, most drummers, it's like, okay, drop a stick. Well, I can kind of play with one hand for a second and pick up the other stick wherever I keep it. But you still have to keep your head like on the microphone. Like does that happen to you? No, I don't want to jinx you, but
yeah, I guess it does happen. My greatest enemy on stage is the mic stand. Like if it gets loose or if it, you know, like, cause, I feel really betrayed by it. I think, well, your only job is to hold a mic and you're not doing it. And I can't I'm busy. I can't do your job for you.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's like the slide, you know, sliding around. Like, I don't know if you probably have your shit pretty much on lockdown wherever you are in the world, but like occasionally you'll be playing some rental kit. You know what I mean? You won't be comfortable with it. Like that must be such a challenge for you.
Yeah, I like to try to keep those variables pretty consistent. You know, playing my own drums and things. Not because I'm a snob about drums, but because exactly for that reason. Like I've got too much to worry about physically during the show to worry about like where the rack tom is, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, my favorite thing was when you were on Letterman. I remember you put on your kit, "They are mine," because I know Letterman always asks the drummer at the end, "Hey, nice drums. Are they yours?"
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I like that. That was really cute when I saw that on TV, whenever that was.
I was trying to troll him into asking me because he's asked some friends of mine and I'm jealous about it. So
did he not ask you?
I don't think he did. Yeah.
No, I actually rewatched the footage. I was like, I remember some band had it. I'm like, I'm pretty sure it was DFA. And I was like, I got to go back and look. And I was like, yeah, fuck yeah, I was right. So
I can't even watch that performance.
Oh, really? It was a tough one.
Oh, it was just like, you know, high stress. It's like, that's another example where I was like, I didn't really figure out how to sing that song live for another like 6 months on the road. And we got the band to play along with us. And, you know, you just assume they're going to play all the right chords. And it was a little bit, it was cool. It was amazing. But, you know, it's one of those things, like, I can't go back and listen to a lot of the stuff that we've done in the past because I'm just like, I don't want to get bogged down with the details, you know.
It's a journey, man. It's a journey. And here we are, and you're doing great in sunny Los Angeles, California. You're killing it, man. You ever look into a custom mic stand? Would that help?
I've had...
get one built, you know?
Yeah, like the guy from Korn, just like get some kind of like something covered in spikes and scrolls and get all chromed out.
Well, you could, I guess. I don't know if that's quite your vibe, but...
Or just covered in bandanas like Steven Tyler.
Sure, you could do that. No, I just mean like one that's like welded together that doesn't move.
Yeah, we have a friend who's a welder who's offered on numerous occasions, but for whatever reason, I've never gotten around to it. I bought like this stupid expensive mic stand at one point and it still failed me. So it's my cross to bear. If I'm ever going to get crucified, it's going to be on a mic stand.
That's very funny. Yeah. Oh my God. Speaking of, you know, you're making me laugh a lot in this podcast. I always thought your band had this dynamic where, like, you guys didn't take yourself very seriously, but everyone else seemed to take you really seriously.
Yeah, I mean, we take ourselves, we take the music seriously.
Sure, of course.
But all the stuff surrounding it, you know, we basically just... we're just trying to amuse ourselves, you know?
Yeah.
So there were periods in this band where when we were driving to the show, like, you know, those long drives, you know, I'd be kind of thinking up fun things to say between songs and think of it, you know, I was basically writing us like a comedy set. And
yeah,
I would think of,
totally.
You know, and I also, we had the experience early on of touring with bands that, kind of, you know, they press play on their show and they would just kind of say the same things between songs. And and I get why people do that. I understand. I totally get that. But I wanted to avoid that. So I was always trying to think up of fresh material and see how far I could push something, like, you know, say something kind of off color, but see if I could keep the audience on side with me, you know?
Yeah.
So that was kind of the, at first it was strictly just like inside jokes. And then I think I saw a band just be like that really insular, like van joke.
Yeah.
Like van joke banter. And I think that that's so shit. Like I can't condone that anymore. Like,
yeah,
the idea of, oh, we had so much fun all day in the van and these are the funny things. Oh, so, you know, whatever. Just like, you know what it is, like that van joke banter.
Totally.
So I try to transcend that, but also, in the early days, we were pretty like confrontational to the audience because we were a weird band and we didn't necessarily fit in with the bands we were supporting or playing with, and audiences didn't know how to deal with us and we were loud. And so I was like far more confrontational with the audience. almost like just as a defense mechanism, you know? And then that turned into the idea of getting everyone on your side and making it so that the whole, if you're having a laugh, then we're all having a laugh, you know?
Sure.
I don't like, and even when it gets down to like singling someone out in the audience, it's never like this, it's never like competitive. It's always, in a way that we can kind of laugh at one another, you know?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Yeah. That also gets kind of burdensome after a while. And there was a long stretch on the last record where I basically didn't say anything between songs. We just kind of had samples playing through to kind of bring more severity into the set. And also mm-hmm. because we started using in-ear monitors, and I found that really disconnected me from the audience.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah, it became difficult to have that like casual banter. And also when you're playing bigger stages, like when the audience is far away from you, it kind of gets that way naturally. Like you kind of get a little bit disconnected, and trying to conjure that simpatico, it's difficult. It's not easy.
No, it isn't easy at all. Conjure that simpatico. I'm like, whoa, dude. And I gotta admit, all I thought about was like high speed internet from the 90s.
Yeah.
Simpatico was a company.
Yeah, it sure
I'll,
was.
I'll admit, you threw me off a little bit. In-ear monitors, yeah, I'm almost a little surprised that you switched to in-ear monitors after this long, because you've been doing it so long. You probably are playing venues that have pretty good monitors where you can get pretty consistent mixes. So I'm surprised you went that route.
You know, it's always been really difficult to get, because of the drum, because of the lead vocal mic being at drum position, you get so much fucking cymbals and,
oh yeah,
like it's an insane amount of other noise into
sense.
The vocal mic. And it's always been really hard to turn my vocal up loud enough to hear it in the monitor without things feeding back. Like it was really, really challenging. And so a lot of the times I was just, you know, doing my best to pitch to the PA and, just, you know, hoping for the best. And after, you know, years of doing that, to mixed results, I was just like, the in-ear thing is, it's just for me as a singing drummer, it's just way, way, way better.
No, it's great. My band has been using them for a long time, and I don't think we could ever go back. That's for sure. But I do remember like that first show when you're wearing in-ear monitors, and it's like, it was the worst, like the worst feeling ever. You couldn't hear anything. You know, I ripped mine out after like two songs, the first show.
Brutal. That's called treating yourself. Sometimes, at the end of the set, I'll pull one out just to treat myself, just to get that old feeling back, you know?
You don't pull one out between songs when you're talking to the crowd? I usually pull one out just for some kind of, like, in case someone yells something, I can kind of hear it or whatever.
I've been very self-aware about not adding extra tasks to my to my job. So even the idea of like pulling out an earpiece and putting it back in, things like I think of it as like a, that's just another thing I got to do here, you know?
I get it, man.
Yeah.
I get it. A guy that wears a lot of hats on stage, off stage. What's going on with your solo stuff? I know you were doing that for a while. It seems like it's a bit on ice at the moment. Are you just focusing on Death From Above?
Yeah. You know, when we started playing again, and when we made the last record, you know, I decided to just totally dedicate myself to this, you know, and, I didn't want to have to compartmentalize my ideas and go like, well, this is Sebastian Granger song, this is a Death From Above song.
Right.
I wanted to kind of throw everything in, you know, do the best work I could do. And, I didn't want to think of Death From Above as not my band, you know, which, because we weren't a band for so long in the middle, there was this mentality that like, this is like a third entity that isn't the two individuals. And I don't think that that's a healthy attitude to have. And also it's like, this is my fucking band, you know?
Sure.
I want to put everything I have into it. And so the, you know, I still have, solo, you know, ideas and aspirations, But they're definitely not as, you know, important to me at the moment.
Cool. That's yeah. great. Great answer. Great yeah. answer. And of course, the name change back from Death From Above 1979 to Death From Above. Couple things I love about it, and this goes back to what I was talking about with the whole, you know, humor and not seriousness.
Mm-hmm.
Like when this came out, a lot of people, when they would have to change their band name, would kind of say like, yeah, we got to do it for legal reasons, blah, blah, blah. You were like, fuck this guy, fuck you, I hope you die in a plane crash, or whatever the statement was. Like, you literally, and there's obviously an element of humor to that too.
Yeah, it's... I mean, I was upset, but
right, but, of course.
We were having fun. We're just, yeah, I don't know. What are you going to do? I mean, the reason why we changed it back was basically because, you know, for various humorous reasons, but also, you know, the idea that we've had this band name, and I don't not like the full band name with 1979. It's not like it's basically I'm impartial towards it, you know, but
yeah.
The idea that we changed our name for some like lame bureaucratic legal, like bullshit, super boring, like guy in an office reason, you know, and we were just carrying it around with us for so many years. And, so that was the main motivation for me. It's like, why do we have to have this? Like, it's like we had to fill out this like government form, like fill out form like C-22 and to add a number to the end of your, you know, the end of your band
right.
name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my favorite thing is what you said for your new single Freeze Me, when you're like, the final straw of like changing the name back was, I was making the art for our single Freeze Me and I wanted to write the name out in ice. So I ordered an ice cube tray of the alphabet. And there were no numbers, so that was that.
Yeah, that's basically it. I sent the artwork to Jesse and our manager, and I was like, well, here it is. There were no numbers, you know?
They're like, ah, fuck it. But doesn't that happen as you get older? I mean, and like, we're close to the same age. Like, you just get to some age, and you're kind of just like, you know what? Fuck it. Like, you know? Like, what's the worst that could happen? They send you another cease and desist, like, what, 15 years later?
Yeah. And, you know, to be honest, we never saw any document. It's not like someone sent it to us. It's someone apparently sent it to someone, and then someone emailed us and said we had to do this thing. And, you know, so there was no... And the other perspective, like James Murphy from DFA Records, his perspective was basically he wasn't even really involved. And he had a totally different perspective on it that wasn't really clear, you know, until years later. And, like, you know, I've met the guy, hung out with him a little bit. Jesse and him are, you know, buds through the kind of disco world. And, he's always been really cool with us. So, you know, when we just on a whim, we're like, let's just do this, you know, revert. He was asked by a bunch of people to comment on it, and he started writing up this like official response. And then he was like, fuck that. I'm just going to text Jesse and be like, it's cool, brother, you know? And right. that's what he did. And that was that. So I doubt anyone's going to.
Is there any fear? Like, you got all these headline shows coming up. Is there any fear that like some people might somehow miss the memo and be like, oh, it's not the real Death From Above. It's like a different band. Cause there's no 1979. Is there any fear of that?
No, you'd have to be, you would have to be so disconnected from, you know, your phone would have to be flushed down the toilet for like 2 weeks, you know?
I don't know, man. I hate to say people are stupid, but people are stupid.
Well, no comment.
Well, yeah. So you got a big tour coming up. Is there anything to plug there you want to plug? Or, I mean, the new record is out now. Before I let you go.
No, I mean, just, you know, buy the record, come to the shows, and buy a t-shirt. Who knows? I don't know.
Buy a t-shirt with no 1979 on it.
Or maybe a 1979. Who knows?
You still have them. They'd be leftover ones from years ago. They got to sell them. Yeah. I know how it is, man. Warehouse somewhere has all these shirts. Oh, well, okay. Well, we'll keep the 1979 going for a little while.
Well, we still have the website. I think the iTunes hasn't switched over, so it's just whatever. We're a band with two names, two guys, one name each. It's great.
Well, you're clearly the 1979, so that makes sense.
Yeah,
love
exactly.
The tattoo. There you go. Sebastian, thanks again for taking the time. I appreciate it. And all the best with going back on tour.
Awesome. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, man. Cheers.
Okay. See ya.
See ya. So there it is with Sebastian. That dude had me cracking up like the whole podcast. Thanks again so much, Sebastian, for doing it. Also, shout out to my friend Gordy Ball for hooking it up. And you know, it really is crazy just how much talent this guy and this band has. The fact that they can basically switch instruments on a whim, they can do everything. They understand music, they understand recording, they understand the technical aspects. And obviously it's a band a lot of people like and a lot of people care about, but I actually feel like Death From Above doesn't get as much credit as they deserve. Anyways, I will leave you with a tune. I absolutely love their new record, and one of my favorite tracks is the last song. It's called Holy Books. Here it is. Check it out. Death From Above on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love. See you next week.
Now it goes.
Hello? 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 Oh, yeah, you are there. You're still there. Wow. You're still here listening to me speaking from the streets of Germany. And you might ask yourself, well, why? Is it because you wish this episode was longer? Do you wish there was more? Do you wish, have you listened to all 97 episodes and you're like, now what? Now what do I do? Well, if this sounds like you, you're in luck. Because I want to tell you right now about the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. This podcast will always be free. Don't worry about that. It will always be free. It'll pop up on your phone every Tuesday. But for some people, that's just not enough. You want more episodes, bonus episodes. Maybe you want to interact with other fans of the show or myself on a Facebook group. Maybe you want Lead Singer Syndrome merchandise. Maybe you want things shipped to your house every 3 months. Maybe some cool patches. I don't know. But one thing is for sure. This show does take money to keep going week after week. Hosting this stuff is not free, and it does take up a pretty decent chunk of my time. So if you have a few extra dollars a month, it really, really would help me keep the lights on around here and keep this show growing and going week after week. For as little as $6, you can join the All Access Club. I won't harp on it anymore. I just want you to check out the website and see if it's right for you. And definitely, it would help me out tremendously if you could become a member and join the other 200 plus members of this thing that we already have. The link is leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. Again, leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. As little as $6 a month gets you in. And again, you'll get some really cool perks, some bonus content, and at the same time, you'll be helping out the show. Thanks for listening. I really do appreciate it. Until next time, have a great week.